WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Friday, June 16th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. In this episode, we're discussing the surveillance state. Watch this. Iconic opening sequence of Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back. An imposing Imperial Star Destroyer looms through the vastness of space, when suddenly a number of smaller ships emerge from it, flying off into the cosmos. One of them lands on a planet covered with ice. The ice planet is Hoth, home to Echo Base, the new secret Rebel Alliance outpost. Soon enough, the object launched by the Empire from its starship is detected by the base, and beloved Rebel anti-hero Han Solo moves to investigate. He learns it's an Imperial probe droid, made for surveillance. Han destroys the probe, but not before it reports the location of the Rebel base. Since 1980, the probe droid has been one of the symbols of the Empire's galactic evil despotism, and it's also been science fiction fantasy. But that's no longer the case. Home security company Ring is now accepting invitations for what it calls its Always Home Can, a device the company describes as the world's first flying indoor security camera for your home. This new gadget is quite literally an Imperial probe droid you can buy and use in your home. It's a little cuter than the massive deadly drone in Star Wars, but in principle, it's the same. And it's moreover a concerning sign that the surveillance droid in Star Wars is about to become our future. It's worrisome that selling spyware for people to install in their homes has become a successful big business. Devices like the Ring collect and analyze data about the intimate details of people's homes and lives using AI algorithms. Yet the customer willingly brings these privacy invasions into their lives. More troubling is the probability that state authorities will begin using similar technologies in public, or that the government will force people to use AI surveillance technologies whether they want to or not. Probe droids forced on the public almost became a reality during the COVID pandemic. In Westport, Connecticut, law enforcement hoped to use drones to police COVID compliance.
The town of Westport, Connecticut will begin using pandemic drone test flights to combat the spread of coronavirus. These drones will be equipped with a system that displays a person's fever, heart, and respiratory rates. And it can also detect people sneezing and coughing in crowds or even where people may work to congregate. The technology can accurately detect infectious conditions from a distance of nearly 200 feet and can also measure social distancing.
Dragonfly Inc., the Canadian drone company behind the technology, described how its drone surveillance system works. Watch this.
Dragonfly's public health and safety system uses standard 4K cameras to provide anonymized data on social distancing, heart rate, respiratory rate, and fever detection, all in the service of providing population health data to our public safety officials. The system does not collect individualized data. The system does not identify people. The system takes population samples and provides this anonymized data to our public safety officials so that we can have clear data giving us indication of population health and allowing our officials to make decisions based on real data.
The company's efforts, which are quite innovative, continue to target surveillance applications. At the close of 2022, the company announced that it would partner with another company to develop and deploy drones for monitoring public safety.
These aerial systems are built with custom payloads and sensors capable of providing live video feeds, communication, and data collection at public events to minimize risk associated with large gatherings.
Drone-based AI surveillance is a reality that will soon be coming to a public event near you. But it's not the only surveillance initiative that will intrude in your daily life. Last year, Congress mandated that cars be equipped with sensors and AI systems to determine if a driver is impaired. Language in the infrastructure bill calls for new cars to, quote, passively monitor the performance of a driver and to prevent or limit car operation if an impairment is detected. Cars will also passively and accurately detect whether the blood and alcohol concentration of a driver is equal to or greater than specified limits. Attorney Jeff Hampton with Hampton Criminal Defense Attorneys discussed this in a recent commentary.
Let's take a look at this for a minute. So here's what it says. For connected vehicles to monitor drivers, there will be some form of technology that will require the collection of data while a driver is in the car's interior. The interior of the car, and here's the issue. This now collides with what the law says. Under New York versus Class 475 U.S. 106, a Supreme Court decision decided back in 1986, the court has said that the interior of a car is considered a place with a reasonable expectation of privacy even under the fourth, as defined under the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. So the problem is we also know people, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't exactly feel very comfortable knowing that some algorithm or some monitoring device can take over my car whenever it wants to, and I don't have any control over it. So the problem is when we look at this type of structure, one of the things we have to figure out is we understand that according to this new bill, that the interior of the car is going to be monitored. There's going to be a data collection of everything that the driver is doing as they drive the vehicle. And so one of the things that we see, for example, a video recording of the interior is going to be allowed to record certain things, racial or ethnic information. It will record the likeness of the driver and the passengers. And it will, if the vehicle can monitor the speed limit of the road, it can provide precise geolocation. It's also likely going to be able to monitor your speed. So it's going to be able to tell if you were speeding at any certain period of time. This is all the stuff that's talking about that's in the infrastructure bill that's required.
These are just two of a growing web of technologies that threaten to dramatically reshape human life into a form described as the polyopticon. Stephanie Sherman is at the University of the Arts London Central St. Martin School of Art and Design. Her expertise includes having co-led the City Design Studio at the Royal College of Art, a program focused on envisioning new concepts of urban life. Her nightmare vision of the polyopticon will certainly be a new concept for human life if realized. According to Sherman in the journal AI and Society in 2022, the future human environment will be, quote, the polyopticon, defined as an urban environment of sensing, interacting, stimulating, and simulating intelligences that aggregates into a multi-perspectival and trans-perspectival network of sensing, knowing, and sharing. For those living within the polyoptagon, she said, the distribution of sensing and sense-making produces forms of collective exhibitionism and presents new capacities for the algorithmic governance and regulation of systems and the agents within them. The key takeaway from Sherman is that the polyoptagon pretty much already exists. Everything you do or say has been recorded and stored by governments or corporations. Edward Snowden warned about this just a month ago. And he warned that we're being watched all the time.
But the reality of the world we live in is that corporations and governments are observing us more and more. We are becoming more legible to them, and we are becoming more malleable before them. Because if they can observe enough of your behavior, they can predict your behavior, particularly as these valuables or as these models become more advanced. And it doesn't have to be 10 out of 10 times, but everybody understands you have a favorite item on the menu. You likely have a favorite seat in the restaurant. You view the tabs in your browser in a certain order. You know, you don't even type in the website name. You just refresh on it or click to the other one. When your browser closes and then it reopens, that behavior is unique to you. How many people in the world do you think share the exact set of browser tabs that you have open? People don't understand that 1 million is a very small number to a machine. And so, like, when you have this delta in legibility, you have this delta in capability, how are we going to control the institutions that are controlling us if we don't have access to similar capabilities?
The Polyopticon is growing, largely unseen, like some form of underground cyber fungus. If it's completed, there may be no way to control the system, something Stephanie Sherman warned about. Quote, neither bureaucrats nor machines watch over us with a loving grace, she wrote. And she warned that we must be prepared to navigate the myriad unintended outcomes of urban AIs as they evolve beyond human comprehensibility. In our current geopolitical climate, one entrenched power collective seeks to assume more power to control the world, its resources, and its population. There's very little interest among this elite group in reining in AI systems that comprise the Polyopticon. In fact, it's being built because they welcome it. And it's nearly complete. Once it's fully finished, they believe it will serve their purpose of cementing their ascendancy as gods on Earth. But it doesn't need to happen that way, and it can still be stopped. Shining a light on the situation and raising awareness is the first step. Working through local leaders and then state and federal representatives is the second. Stopping all smart city initiatives through citizen engagement can prevent the arrival of the Polyopticon. And consistently warning about the dangers that uncontrollable and unaccountable AI systems pose is absolutely necessary to prevent the rise of all-powerful algorithmic tyranny. Stay tuned, folks, because after the break, Gary, Steve, and I will talk about the budding AI surveillance system. We'll be right back.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon. Join us in restoring this great nation.
Welcome back. So we discussed this budding AI surveillance system, and I have with me Editor-in-Chief of The New American, Gary Benoit, and Executive Senior Editor, Steve Bonta. So Steve, I was thinking about you, how you lived in China for some time, and we know that China is kind of the vanguard of the AI surveillance system. But what are your thoughts as far as how far behind, or if are we even behind China on the surveillance aspect?
I would say we're not behind in quality, and probably in some ways respects the technology that we have available to conduct surveillance is better. Because most of the technology in China tends to be, you know, knockoffs of Western technology or stuff that's outright manufactured in China and sold to China by European and American corporations. However, China is far ahead, well, maybe not far ahead of us, but they are certainly ahead of us in this move toward total panopticon sort of technology. For example, in the United States, this doesn't really, I wouldn't even consider high tech. CCTVs first became into vogue, 20 years ago-ish. And from that time forth, it's become increasingly hard to commit a crime or do anything sketchy in a public place because the chances are somewhere there's a CCTV camera, mm-hmm. either on a public facility like a stoplight or something like that, or in some store that happens to catch the parking lot that you chose to violate the law or whatever, right? So CCTV cameras are, we think, fairly ubiquitous. But now you go to China, and they're more than ubiquitous. They have banks and banks of them, most of them installed by the government in every road, everywhere there's any type of a large pole, on all the expressways.
Are those the cameras you're referring to in case there's someone listening?
Yeah, CCTV cameras, right?
Okay.
And so they will have on all the new expressways in the Chinese urban areas like Shanghai, where I was living, they have at intervals of no more than every half mile or so, they'll have a big mm-hmm. steel pole beam across the highway, and there will be an entire bank of these things, like 50 or 60 of them, lined across. And not only are they pointed at you, but they flash very brightly as your car passes under. And by brightly, I mean it can actually hurt your eyes. So these bright flash, very much, very in your face, very much calculated to remind you that no matter where you go, you're in most watched. Developed public areas in China, you're being watched. And you're literally being watched, such that these cameras are all being manned by thousands of people in police stations whose job it is to sit in front of the cameras, in front of the screens, you know, a whole room full of screens, mm-hmm. and just watch them 24/7. That's what they do.
That sounds like a terrible job.
And that's just CCTV technology. Now, online, again, they have in place, and of course, they don't really have any notion of privacy or anything like that. So there are no impediments like the Constitution and Bill of Rights that Gary has in front of him in China. So they simply do what they want. And what they want is to get to the point where every single act that you do online, whether on a cell phone or a computer, whether via WeChat, which is their most most popular all-purpose communication and social media.
It's everything. You buy, you communicate,
You can buy, you can sell, you can do all kinds of things with WeChat. It's very useful, to be sure, but it's also 100% surveilled. If not by people, then there are bots that are constantly looking in all the WeChat messages for certain keywords. So, for example, if you mention Winnie the Pooh, you're going to get in trouble because Winnie the Pooh was used a few years ago to sort of make fun of Xi Jinping. And so that now all references to Pooh are prohibited and so forth and so on. And
wait, what does that mean? How do they prohibit that? Do they show up at your door? You at type.
Oh, absolutely. Sure, they will. If you do that, if you are found using a VPN, which will allow you via your cell phone or your laptop to circumvent the Great Firewall and access websites outside of China, which include nowadays Wikipedia, pretty much any Western news organization, except Fox News, which was strange. At least when I was last in China a year ago, you could actually still access most of Fox News without a VPN. But all the other news services are blocked. And they've cottoned on to the fact that the secondary, libertarian website like lewrockwell.com is now blocked as well. And the New American sometimes is blocked, depending on where you are. And so if you access those, or if you mention these things in your chats and communications, or if you start a little conversation with a friend on WeChat and start complaining about the Communist Party or Xi Jinping, or even saying bad things about China in general, or opining that maybe Taiwan is in fact an independent country, or any of a whole range of literally hundreds, if not thousands of topics, obviously the Tiananmen Square, all this stuff is forbidden, you will be notified of it.
Wow. How does that work? They send you an email, they call you?
You'll get a call or you'll get a message in WeChat. And
Is it a robot that talks or is it a person?
Well, no, I don't know exactly. But the code that they will use is you'll be invited to come down to the local police station to he cha, which means to drink tea. And so this is a joke. You go down there to drink tea with them. Of course, everything's very friendly and passive aggressive. Right. And you'll go down and then they'll strap you into the dragon chair or whatever. And they will let you know what a terrible, and they'll extract a confession from you. And then they'll put that on WeChat and humiliate you. And if you're lucky, you'll be allowed to continue to buy and sell and to travel. If you're less lucky, if you're a repeat offender, they will take away your travel, including internal travel privileges. Mm-hmm. You can't buy and sell anymore online. It's truly formidable. All of this we could do quite easily in the United States if it were not for what Gary wants to talk about. So I'm going to shut up and let him talk about it if it were not for this document.
What do you got there, Gary?
Well, I got a copy of the Constitution because I figured that's a good place to start in terms of what the United States should be like. Uh-huh. The Constitution is the law of the land, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if anyone would argue against that, but it's always good for a refresher.
I'd like to read from Amendment 4, and it's not that long. I'm going to read the entire amendment. This, of course, being part of the Bill of Rights. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. And obviously, this Constitution is being violated. That's the bad news. But the good news, of course, is that we still have the Constitution. It still is the law of the land. And all we have to do is to better inform people and get people involved in this country and have people reclaim their heritage. Yeah. To have people insist that the Constitution be enforced.
So are you saying when they have these in public spaces, which we know they have here in the United States, that violates the Constitution because it's a search.
The surveillance state is being used is a form of search, and actually we've gone way beyond, I think, what was described by George Orwell in his dystopian novel 1984. Mm-hmm. I mean, just imagine if George Orwell knew about the technology that we had today, what 1984 could have looked like.
Well, and like we pointed out in the first segment, though, lots of people are inviting this technology in their home, these, you know, the Ring mm-hmm. gadget and various things. What do you guys make of that? That seems to be a clever way.
Well, I just want to point something out, mm-hmm. and it's easy to ascribe all of this to cutting-edge technology. But in fact, this idea of a total surveillance state was ended up being familiar to the founding fathers. In England, roughly the time of the founding, a rough contemporary of the founding fathers, there was a man named Jeremy Bentham, who is today known as this somewhat eccentric but perhaps brilliant philosopher. He was a guy with a lot of different ideas, and one of his favorite ideas was what he called the panopticon, a word I used earlier reference to technology. Right. Panopticon comes from the Greek roots pan, which means everything or all, and opticon, of course, optical or eye or seeing. But his idea was, using the technology of the day, that people could be regimented in such a way that they could all live and work in huge government-owned buildings that would have their apartments, and then they'd have their workplace, kind of like the 15-minute city, right? Mm-hmm. Which is another idea that we think is new. But these buildings, crucially, would be equipped with a very sophisticated array of tubes with mirrors in them that would allow certain people, overseers, in strategic spots to literally watch what everyone was doing all the time. And in this way, could prevent any possible appearance of crime or vice. And this was not hyperbole. It was not satire. Bentham thought it was such a great idea that he actually approached Thomas Jefferson, among others, about it. I believe he sent him detailed ideas. Well, you know, you have this new country of yours, and you're trying. This is the way, you know, if you want to ensure peace and prosperity and stability, here's what you need to do. Needless to say, Jefferson was not impressed. But the idea is not a new one.
I wonder what was Jefferson's response.
I don't know. I don't think history records it. I think he may not have. But we do
that
know.
Seems maybe like he was too shocked to say it.
Well, Bentham, of course, was trying to make money out of it. He was pretty eccentric. Witness the fact that when in his will, he actually declared that upon his demise, his body was to be sent to a taxidermist and stuffed and placed on a chair at his favorite learned society. And it sits there to this day. You can actually see his mummified remains seated in a chair inside a glass case somewhere in London. I forget exactly the name of the spot. But in any case, that's the guy who was sort of the originator of this idea of the total surveillance state.
But not all of us may want to be on display to that extent. And of course, in the 21st century, with the technology we have today, we're actually going beyond the panopticon, but to the polyopticon.
Yeah,
that was discussed earlier.
I want to go back to this aspect where we are inviting, because I think this is the key to stopping this. Like we said at the end of this new segment, and like Gary had mentioned, we want to bring awareness, because I think, you know, we'll touch that more on that later, but a large part of this, I think people don't know is happening. You know, some of us live in small towns and whatever, but most don't know this is.
You got to watch that term awareness, because that's DARPA's like their motto.
Is that one of their
total information awareness? Yeah. I think it's how they characterize it.
Yeah, but it's why are people inviting this? I mean, you had told me off air, you know, how people in China just love. Do they know? They surely know that they're being watched. So isn't that odd?
Sure. Well, for one thing, they've been conditioned. Do they know anything else? I mean, seriously, if you're growing up in this kind of society.
That's a good point. You know,
can you imagine a different condition?
I was talking to a friend who's a missionary in New York City, and she was kind of evangelizing to a student from China. And she had a conversation about persecution in China. And the girl explained to her these details, and my friend who has grown up here, she's like, oh, wow, that's persecution. And she's like, well, that's, you know, it's just religion. That's how it works. You know, that's normal. Her response to my friend was that, like you said, It was a conditioned response, right. Like it's normal.
But that doesn't apply to all the people. And of course, Steve, having lived there, you can speak to this much better than I can. But how about Christians, for example? Because you have the churches in China that are controlled by the regime, controlled by the Communist Party, right down to the point where the Communist Party will pick the bishops and the ministers and whatnot. But you also have the underground churches that operate outside the watchful eye of the regime.
And at their peril.
Surely the people who attend those underground churches must be very fearful of being detected and what could happen to them.
Many of them are, yeah, sure. I mean, they're all aware of this, but there's sort of a resignedness in China. There's this idea that's been, because China, I mean, you know, totalitarian government actually didn't start with the Communist Party in China. It just happens to be the latest instantiation of it,
right.
And perhaps the most efficient. But, you know, in China, the culture has always been towards, you know, how do we make things maximally stable, avoid creating problems?
Mm.
How do we encourage the collective to work smoothly? You know, and the idea that there might be some worth in individual independence is not really relevant. Individuality and individualism are seen as disruptive.
Well,
so that's why, you know, this total surveillance, if not accepted, is tolerated because, you know, they say, well, it's hard to bear. But on the other hand, everybody being watched all the time means it's really hard to commit crimes.
Oh, yes. Well, let's take a break because I do want to come back to that.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for the New American magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American magazine represents a alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country's in an existential crisis, we remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American Magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. So we've been discussing the growing of AI surveillance technology, and we were about to go into, of all things, the benefits and advantages of AI technology. Steve, I understand you have some thoughts on that. You were talking about crime. I imagine that's certainly the truth, that this technology we have today does, in fact, make it harder to commit crime. So that's a good thing, right?
Well, let's just back up a little bit. The founding fathers like to draw this contrast between what they called the calm of despotism and the tempestuous sea of liberty. There's no question that freedom is more, a free and open society is
messier.
That's the perfect word, yeah. And here's the unvarnished truth. It is in fact, because of this technology we're talking about in the last, before the break, it is a fact that Chinese cities are remarkably safe, okay, just in terms of street crime. Kids travel from one end of Shanghai all the time to the other on the metro, never get robbed, never get kidnapped.
Hmm.
My own daughter, when she was with me, was underage. She would travel around with her friends in the subway. They enjoy, because people know that violent crime is almost unknown in areas where everything is captured on camera. So in that sense, the sort of panopticon minority report mentality is correct, but they're not showing the whole picture. The other side of the picture is that under those conditions, the criminality all migrates upward. Okay, so that you don't have a lot of people, like you don't have people, you know, shootouts in public restaurants, you don't have the gangbanger violence and the stuff that we have here. That's all perpetrated by the government. But of course, it's not regarded as crime because the government does it.
Right.
So the real criminals or the biggest criminals are the people who run the government.
Exactly. So it creates this illusion that things are somehow more secure,
right,
because you are safer in terms of being able to walk down the street and less likely to be pickpocketed.
So somebody riding a bicycle, for example, would feel safe and secure in terms of a petty criminal. But if we go back to Tiananmen Square, where thousands were killed and they were driven over by tanks and whatnot, those crimes were committed by the government.
Right, and this is precisely what happened. While I was in China, we had the COVID lockdowns, and suddenly people realized, oh, okay, now I get it. Because that same government that protected them 24/7 with this suffocating mantle of constant surveillance and security, down to policing every word that they utter, you know, online, also had the ability to lock down entire cities, the entire country in point of fact, to close hospitals and medical services to everyone except people who had COVID, and thereby left lots of other people to just die in the street or whatever, arrested people for protesting, for saying, you know, for trying to steal food because they were literally starving to death in their apartments, and on and on and on. So assuming that was the other side of it.
Right. Assuming they could even get out of their apartment.
Which,
Steve, you know, thank God you were not living in the middle of a big city such as Shanghai, but you were, I guess, within the city limits, and you knew what was happening there. You knew people who lived in the downtown area, but you know, you've told us stories off camera about the despicable conditions where, you know, people were committing suicide en masse and whatnot, and people would leave their apartment without authorization, and I guess if they were lucky, they would simply be put back in their apartment and the door would be locked from the outside so they could not get out again.
Right. And besides that, you know, now the consequence is that Shanghai, I haven't been there in a while, but I understand now that what was once a pretty happy, bustling city is literally a shell of its former self because most of the businesses were driven into bankruptcy.
Yeah.
People's lives were ruined en masse because of what, you know, and the government, why did the government do these things? Well, the answer is very simple, because they could. Right. So the point being is that security that government always, I mean, as you're saying, we're off camera, there's a price to pay. They always say, well, you know, we're going to take your guns. We're going to watch you more closely. We're going to surveil you. And it's all in the name of making your life safer.
Oh, sure.
And for a while,
it appears to be
it seems to work until you have a crisis or something. And then.
Well, that reminds me, though, it's like because some of that, let's bring it back to where we are. During COVID, one of the technologies that we saw was contact tracing. Okay, so I take it
which came from China.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good point.
They pretty much invented it and rolled it out there first. Yep.
So you and me were here, Gary, during that terrible time. And what similarities, based on what Steve said, would you say exist?
Well, it sounds to me like we're becoming like China. And of course, we're not all the way there yet, but we're taking strides in that direction.
Yeah.
And, you know, thankfully, there was pushback. There was pushback against the COVID decrees. And so the state backed off to some extent, but it doesn't mean it's not going to come roaring back again. It could be another pandemic, either real or imagined or manufactured. It could be climate change. It could be an economic crisis.
Yeah.
It could be war. But there's no question, all these things happen simultaneously, but there is absolutely no question. The evidence is overwhelming, that there are people who are conspiring, and they include people in big government, big business, big media.
Yeah.
They are conspiring in order to be the masters of the universe.
Yeah.
And they're not going to tell you, any more than they would in China, that our purpose is to make you slaves. You will bow to our whims, and you know, they don't present it that way. They always present it from the point of view of being for the good of the people, and certainly, unless this is stopped, unless the American people rise up and use the freedoms that we have, use those freedoms in order to protect our freedoms, to preserve our freedoms, and then to restore those freedoms that we've already lost. Unless that happens, it is going to become just like China, and I think even worse. I mean, don't think that we're not going to have killing fields here, just like we did in other parts of the world by these totalitarians or would-be totalitarians.
Well, we're talking about this conditioning. And so, again, I want to ask Steve, who lives here, he grew up here, and then he was in China. What is your take as far as the similarities or the contrast of how conditioned we have become as Americans to be more collectivist and to seek the safety of the state as much as it appears that it's happening in China? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, after several years abroad and not going to the United States during that period, I was quite shocked when I came back at how much worse things had gotten. But I think one of the things that's I find ironic is that today's radical leftists who have as their goal setting up a totalitarian sort of a Marxist society, they would themselves would not use the word totalitarian, of course. They rely crucially on the very freedoms that we espouse, the freedom to voice your opinion and all this kind of thing, to demonstrate peacefully and so forth and so on. And also they're very individualistic in their approach. So if you look at them, a lot of them are real characters. They wouldn't last 2 days under a China-type regime. Yeah. Because what happens once the true believers take over? First, they kill all the useful idiots that helped them get to power. And then the people who have the managerial chops coupled with the psychotic ruthlessness to, to do what needs to be done to pacify the situation, go out and they kill everybody that resists. And then on the remainder, they always impose this sort of suffocating regimen of controls. And after a couple of generations, people become used to it.
Yeah,
and
they don't know any different.
That calm of despotism becomes the norm. Mm. And they get to the point where they have no tolerance for too much conflict. Mm. So, for example, in China, you don't just get in trouble for criticizing individuals like Xi Jinping or the Communist Party or the principles of communism or Mao or something like that. You can get in trouble for criticizing China, for saying, this country has too much smog, or my goodness, just making general criticizing any aspect of Chinese culture, saying anything negative, publishing a photo that in any way, might cast, a photo of somebody who got hit by a car, let's say, in the street or something, and making some comment about how terrible the traffic is. Anything like that, you'll get in trouble for, because it's viewed as disrupting that calm of despotism
that
needs to be maintained.
Do you see, you mentioned no tolerance, do you see a parallel between that over there and, for instance, what we've seen with the federal government here coming down on, for instance, parents, apparently, or they were considering coming down on parents who are voicing opposition to the trans madness in schools, or patriots. Apparently, they have that school, that triangle of right-wing tyranny or whatever, where everyone who's anywhere right of Joe Manchin apparently might be a suspect. Betsy Ross fight, we learned that the FBI has these signals, and these are some of the flags. Isn't that kind of where, that seems to be
similar. Sure. What happens as radical leftism gets more and more deeply rooted is that the apparatus, the legitimate apparatus of state security or whatever it happens to be, the police and the law enforcement and investigative agencies and so forth, the intelligence agencies, become more and more concerned not about criminal behavior, but about disruptive behavior. Anyone who's going to be disruptive to the system that they want to maintain, because they know that their maintenance of power depends crucially about people not getting too riled up. Also, they might end up hanging from lampposts or something like that.
But disruptive is defined by the state.
Absolutely.
Because when the state acquires total unrestrained power, the state does not want any competition. The state actually imagines itself as being a god on earth, right?
Absolutely.
And religion becomes targeted too, because they don't want any competition. The family becomes targeted because they don't want any competition. And so now in California, and we covered this in
yesterday's
show, now we have legislation that's being considered in the state legislature in California that has a good chance of passage, where if it is enacted, the state actually would be empowered to take children away from parents.
Right.
If the parents do not affirm the so-called
gender identity of whatever this
is determined by their children. That would now be, if this legislation goes through, considered a form of child abuse in California. So the family very much is being targeted.
Well, and if you look at it as from an ideological point of view, it all seems very confusing. So, for example, in China and in many established communist or otherwise totalitarian regimes like Iran, for example, their hallmark is typically social conservatism, where they crack down on things like homosexuality and adultery and all these types of things.
Yeah, and Steve, I want to stop you there, because you talked about earlier getting rid of the useful idiots, that this is what the communists do. And when you said that, I was thinking about, the transgender revolution and the LGBTQ revolution and whatnot. Would you see those as useful idiots?
Absolutely.
Because the communists encouraged this in, countries that they want to subvert. They want to create moral anarchy, so to speak. But when a country becomes communist or totalitarian, they no longer want those people around.
Well, right. Obviously, that they are part of the useful idiot classes. But what the point I was leading to is that the common thread. On the one hand, to look at it, in many respects, the Ayatollahs of Iran, the communist dictators of China and Cuba and so forth, don't seem to in terms of their style. Mm-hmm. Don't seem to have much in common with these unruly mobs, woke mobs here in the West. Mm-hmm. We call them all Marxists or leftists. Seems somehow a misapplication of the term. Here's the point. Anyone who believes that the state ought to act in loco dei, right, will brook no competition, mm-hmm. will brook no intercessor between the state and the individuals that it needs to mold and repress and eliminate if necessary, whether that be the family or any other traditional social structures associated with the clan or whatever. Obviously, religion of all sorts is an impediment. Sometimes religion is enlisted as an ally if in some of these, like in Iran, but not so much. That's not the path that the communists generally go. But that's the commonality. Now, the woke mobs and what they're trying to accomplish. What is that? Well, they believe in principle in the same thing as old-fashioned communists do, namely that the solution to all problems is the unlimited creative application of government power, which they assume they will be the ones to wield. Of course, they will be sadly mistaken, most of them, when they actually...
The very few who rise to the top.
What would they need once the revolution is over? What would they need with these like purple-haired freaks, mm-hmm. going around and screaming? Because that was part of the communist tactic anyway, right? You use them to destroy the current structure, and then you get rid of them to build the big surveillance.
Another point worth pointing out is that the model we have in China is much closer, they call it, socialism with Chinese characteristics, is more instructive than what we ever get from the Soviet Union, because the Chinese government in its Cultural Revolution did openly try to subvert and destroy the family. Then the one-child policy that they had for decades and everything mm-hmm. else was far beyond anything that the Soviets ever accomplished or really even tried to accomplish. They did have a mini social cultural revolution under Stalin, but it was nowhere near as comprehensive. And so we're seeing literally an American-style cultural revolution of its own, whose purpose is, like its predecessors in China and the Soviet Union, to soften up the population and prepare us for the age of total government.
Yep. And yet we can certainly get back to our traditional morality and get back to our constitutional form of government.
We have to, or we're going to end up like China. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. And folks, and we will be back with the last segment of the New American TV.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
Who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand when necessary.
And now we go to our action segment where Lisa Von Geldern interviews the coordinator for Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Northern Illinois, Nicole Sanders. Watch.
Hi, this is Lisa Von Geldern. I'm here today with Nicole Sanders. Nicole is the John Birch Society field coordinator for Wisconsin, part of Illinois. Where else? You have
Minnesota,
a huge territory.
And a little bit of South Dakota.
Wow. Yeah. A lot of miles on that car, huh?
Sure. Yep.
Okay. So Nicole and I have been talking lately about Agenda 2030, how to fight it, and how to find it in your city, county, town, state. And Nicole's been talking to me about comprehensive planning, which comes out of, I think, the U.S. Planning Association and how do we find our comprehensive plans and why are they concerning?
So you can Google the town you live in and then comprehensive plan. That's how I find most of them. Every state has a comprehensive plan that directs the regional comprehensive plan that directs each city and then each jurisdiction.
So is this being put in by our elected representatives or are these unelected officials and bureaucrats coming in and telling us what to do?
So the American Planning Association has a very large lobbying group and have gotten a lot of states to pass laws requiring a comprehensive plan. I know that in the infrastructure bill that was passed, they put about almost $1 billion in funding going to planning agencies. If your area wants to participate in federal funds for roads, you have to be part of a regional planning commission.
Regional? That sounds like we're losing our rights to our direct representation. Yeah.
And you see this actually across the country. So I was in Indiana with John Schrock, the coordinator there, and we sat in at his city council meeting. And the fire dispatch unit were there because they wanted to combine jurisdictions. So instead of, one town having their own dispatch, their own firefighters, police, they're starting to combine. I know Illinois passed a law that if you have less than 25,000 citizens in your area, you have to combine with a neighboring county. So this is happening across the country right now.
Well, they're doing it where I live in Green Valley, Arizona.
Yeah.
Amazing. So what brought you into learning about these comprehensive plans and doing background research on them?
So a couple of members wanted to start a Agenda 2030 rollback committee, and they were restarting a chapter. So it was just the two of them. So I was trying to help. And we read all of the wrong plans, trying to figure out how embedded is Agenda 21 in your community? And then I found a comprehensive plan. And then Tom DeWeese mm-hmm. talks a lot about it. So I found a lot of things that he wrote. And I've read a half a dozen comprehensive plans. And it wasn't really until I started, I did read the American Planning Association's official dictionary, a little under 500 pages long, where as you start reading every definition, I really started to get a grasp of, my goodness, these comprehensive plans are protecting the environment, trees and wildlife and the fish.
That sounds good.
It does, right? Who doesn't want clean air, clean water, nice places to live? But do you want all of that at the expense of individual property rights? Because that is what's going on. Your local comprehensive plan, and they're the same across the country, even though every small little village, town, all used community input, right? They mm-hmm. had town halls. This is what your community wants. Isn't it wonderful and great?
I've been to some of those meetings. But they use a technique called the Delphi technique,
yes,
correct?
They do. Doesn't matter what you say. They're going to do what they want to do.
That's right.
Led me to start researching more and more to figure out, okay, my goodness, this plan is so much bigger than anything coming out of your state or the state or federal government, right? It's much larger than that. I would say President Clinton, when he created the President's Council on Sustainable Development, he worked with Al Gore to embed the sustainable development principles into every area of government. So if your state,
Wait a second. United Nations, the root of gun regulation. You gave me this beautiful little packet here. Think globally, act locally. It's even in gun laws.
Yeah, and city councils are the ones, the comprehensive plan is your city council's business plan. That is the main document they use in the budget, but that's it. Their job is to fulfill the goals that are in the plan. And, it's how United Nations tasked our officials to take this global plan and make it local. Because, like we said, who doesn't want clean air and clean water and all of that? But when you read the dictionary and you read, the definition for a dangerous use, is any building that has heat and water, gas, electric. That's dangerous.
That's why I want to get rid of our gas stoves.
It's all dangerous. A pollutant is the CO2, you know, the way we breathe.
We're the carbon they want to get rid of, right?
We are the carbon.
We are the carbon they want to get rid of. So, quick question. These plans, they're all over. They're across the country. They're across the world.
Across the world. I mean, China has one. Russia has one. Friendly neighbors to the north and south, they both have one.
And they all look the same.
All about smart growth, environmental protection, and agriculture stewardship. So those
but
are
our farmers already are stewards of the environment.
Yeah.
So are our hunters and our fishermen. They are stewards. They want to protect the environment so they can enjoy it.
Of course.
For generations to come.
Yeah, because they want to. Their land is useless if they don't protect it, if they don't become natural stewards of it.
So this all goes back to really the founding of the John Birch Society and Robert Welch. And one of our premier goals is to get the U.S. out of the U.N. and get the U.N. out of the U.S.
Yeah.
So
and the reason why I've been pushing all of my chapters to really dig into their comprehensive plan, and you know, like let's make a plan to fight back, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, there's nothing one individual chapter or one member can do to get us out of the United Nations, right? That is an effort across all of the states, but there is something that one member or a chapter can do to get Agenda 21 or to get the United Nations out of their backyard.
Right.
You're like I said, your city council controls this plan. There's a city planner that is part of the American Planning Association.
We have one in Green Valley.
And your mayor.
Yes.
A lot of mayors have committees on climate change. And I know Milwaukee, we have a climate change is a radical racial justice. And, you know, all of these DEI committees all working in tangent, too.
So what do your members think about their efforts? What are they doing?
You know, right now it's a lot to wrap your mind around because as you read the plan, nothing sounds like too crazy, you know, other than, you know, the smart growth leading into, you know, the 15-minute cities. But they're very long. You know, I was looking at the Kenosha Comprehensive Plan. It's over 1,000 pages. So right now, chapters are just, you know, trying to read what they can, wrap their mind around it. It's not just the comprehensive plan. There's watershed plans that are even longer than the comprehensive plan. There's a multi-hazard mitigation plans, which is how they are going to get people out of rural areas, out of the suburbs, into city centers. Floodplains are a big one, getting people out of floodplains. But if your property is part of the 100-year flood, it's a floodplain, and you got to go.
Wow. So where are they going to put us all? They're going to put us all together, close
little
in city the cities?
Little city centers next to rail lines.
I think they call them human settlement zones.
Actually, yeah.
Yep.
Human settlements. They will regulate what you can and can't do. This is how they are. You know, states, you see it already happening. So there's been states across the country who have eliminated single-family zoning. For new builds. So basically they're going to you who have a home on a single family lot. Mm-hmm. You can build more buildings on your property. You have a mother-in-law suite if you want. You know, start building more.
Kind of falls in with Mayor Adams's plans in New York to force private homes who have empty bedrooms to house our guests from south of the border.
Yes, yeah. And yep. And in this dictionary, they have different terms. Giving people with a stake in your property a say, giving them like ownership, some type of ownership.
Giving someone a stake in my property.
Yeah, and what you can do. In the dictionary, it talks about how your neighbors, if you have an abutting property line, they can have a say into what you can and can't do. A lot of it is around like open space, and who doesn't want open space? But
they want more buildings on my property so I can put more people there, right?
Correct. Because single family zoning is racist. It is a way to create all white neighborhoods, and is basically racism without saying it out loud.
Boy, planned societies aren't very fun, are they?
not with the planners we have.
No. So, what can you tell me about any of your interactions with elected officials or bureaucrats in cities or counties that you've spoken to about these things? Can you tell me a little bit? You were sharing a story with me today about meeting with someone about the comprehensive plans locally here, and you had an interesting tale to tell.
Yeah, he was interesting. He, I asked a lot of different questions, and one of them was, I would say, each area has a current zoning map, so, their current zoning, but then a future land use map. It's really important to really look at the two and compare them, how much is my area going to change? And I was asking him, what happens if people who own that land, they don't want to change the zoning? What if they're just happy with the way it is? And, they try to push back against it. What happens then? And he said, well, they could file a form with the city council, but in many cases, the city council continues with the zoning that the future land use map states. And the planning commission, goodness, the one here has a whole floor for their planning department. And they are the ones who are making recommendations to your city council about if they should approve anything from the constituents in the area. They get first say. Everything goes to them first.
The planners get first say, not the constituents.
The planners get to see everything first and then give recommendations on how the city council should vote.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. We hope you have a good weekend, and we will see you on Monday.
As a lumberjack, my job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At The New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
The truth is hard to find, but The New American has it. Check it out at thenewamerican.com.